What's up, everybody? This edition of the Masters of Modern podcast is brought to you by Wizardry Foundry, makers of the Grimoire and the Grimoire Pro Tour deck boxes. These are sweet, sweet looking boxes that look like spell books that hold tons of cards. There's two different sizes. One size holds like 1,000 cards. The other one holds somewhere around like 500. They're gourmet boxes. They're luxury. They're made of wood, and they look like an awesome leather-bound book, but they're not made of leather. They're awesome. They're working on a new project right now to print a 3D box on demand for everyone. We have one with like an X-Wing looking thing that we got. It was like a little sample.
It's going to be mine. It's sweet.
It's real cool. You can like build your modern gauntlet, store it in there. We have one that we have our modern gauntlet in that's very, very cool. If you guys use the promotion code MMCAST, JAN150, MMCAST, JAN150 is the code. The first lucky five people get 50% off their purchase of Grimoire on Grimoire Pro Tour in the next 7 days. There is only going to be 5 50% off codes, and these things are like $75. Obviously, that's a great deal, and this is a really, really nice product. It's one of a kind. It's a smaller company, but we definitely have seen people using these things, and they are awesome, so we recommend them. Check it out, and enjoy the show.
Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I'm your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to the week before the Pro Tour.
Bah, 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 bah. I think it's 2 weeks.
No, this is
like a week and a half.
It's next weekend, right?
It's like if this comes out tomorrow, which is Tuesday, it'll be the weekend after the next Tuesday.
So this is the week before the week of the Pro Tour.
Sure. Yeah. Like next week will be our Pro Tour episode.
Look, Alex, do you want to argue semantics about it? We have a guest.
I would rather introduce our awesome guest. So today we have the awesome, who knows more about Pro Tours than anyone, Brian David Marshall.
Yeah, what's up, man?
Hey guys. Well, thanks for having me on.
Dude, yeah. This is crazy. I can't even, we got on the phone with you and it was immediately like, wait, I know that voice. That's the voice of the Pro Tour. I've heard deck techs. I've heard interviews. This is insane. I can't believe it. So welcome to the show, man.
Thanks. Very, very excited to be here. Very excited to talk about the new cards. Get some reps in saying card names before the Pro Tour starts.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
are you more excited about being here or about the Pro Tour?
I'm always super excited about the Pro Tour. I mean, something people don't realize, this February, this Pro Tour is basically the 20th anniversary of the Pro Tour.
Oh yeah, I did. Someone did mention that.
Right. That's because it took a few years, right? It wasn't really until like fifth edition Ice Age that the Pro Tour was like a thing.
Yeah,
right?
February 1996 was Pro Tour 1 in New York.
Yeah, so it was like Necropotence, the first Pro Tour deck.
I was 8. I literally turned 8 probably the day of the Pro Tour, if it was February 3rd in that year, but it probably wasn't.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I already hated you.
Yeah. I hated myself at a rough 8-year-old age.
Now, did you play on the first Pro Tour, or were you already doing coverage?
You know what? I had a store in New York called Neutral Ground.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of this.
And so I was, me and my staff, we were actually working at the event.
Okay, gotcha.
Hosting stuff at the store and, you know, just being sort of a hub for Magic in the New York area.
Gotcha. Now, you used to, remind me, this is you. I used to read a lot of Mothership articles, and I believe was your story about that you would, like, go to a Pro Tour and then you'd eat cake? Is that your...
So we started the tradition at Neutral Ground of whenever someone qualified for the Pro Tour from our group.
Right.
That they had to buy cake for everybody.
If they won, they had to buy the cake.
If you qualify for the Pro Tour, you don't get to the. No one qualifies for the Pro Tour by themselves.
Right.
Right. Like it's the hard work of a pretty dedicated group of people who are all working together, sharing information, sharing cards, sharing deck lists, you know, sharing draft strategies, whatever it is, right? Like there's, and they're cheering you on, right? Like at the end, as you get to win that qualifier, there's a bunch of people there who are sort of sharing in that experience with you, and you reward them for their support and their friendship by buying them cake.
That's delicious. I mean, who doesn't like cake?
Yeah. So we started that tradition. Steve Sadin was the first cake buyer.
Oh, Sadin, I love that.
Winning a PTQ at Neutral Ground. And the tradition has actually migrated west to Portland, where Gabe Carlton Barnes,
okay,
who is an occasional Neutral Grounder over the years,
right,
who has this, you know, whole Portland Magic draft community that's developed around him out there, they've carried that tradition forward. In fact, they made cake playmats.
Oh, nice.
Oh, my gosh.
With the name of everybody from their group who qualified on the playmat, who has qualified for a Pro Tour through their little group. It's a nice tradition. I think everyone should do it.
Yeah, we should.
I think it should just be a rite of magic passage, like that when you qualify for the Pro Tour, you win an RTQ, you top eight a GP, like you should go home and you should buy everybody in your playgroup cake.
Yeah,
it's very simple.
Yeah, Masters of Modern listeners, get on that. Start buying cake for people.
I'm just as intrigued by your idea of buying cake as I am about just like this idea of like really making personalized playmats that don't actually have to just be like the name of a podcast. Like, what if we just like a bunch of us playing at a what if it's like a Grand Prix group of us, like 8 or 10 of us that we're going to make playmats. We're going to design them specifically for this group that one of us is going to win this Grand Prix. You make them. And if no one wins the Grand Prix, who cares? But if one of you does and you made that playmat, how cool is that? You all sign each other's mats, right?
Yeah. I mean, even if you don't, right? It's like that again, it's that experience, that communal experience of going to the event. You know, who were all the, you know, people that you met, the artists that you saw there, the, you know, the tournament organizer, the head judge, the, you know, there's still that communal experience that you could think, man, I think that's a great idea, actually, you know, regardless of whether or not someone qualifies, just to sort of commemorate that experience. Like, we're all going to Grand Prix Vancouver. Let's all make a playmat and go.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, like, that, what you say about the experience, the community, I mean, that's definitely one of the most special parts of Magic. Kessler and I went to GP Vegas this last summer, like most people did. And I got my first pro point there. And that's legitimately the most fun I've ever had at a Magic tournament, was just that weekend. And just, there were so many Magic people and so many tournaments and so many offsite things. It was just awesome. So, I completely agree. I think very, very unmatched special experience. So let me ask you a question. You watched that first pro tour from your store, and you obviously are watching.
So I was actually there. I was at the event.
Okay. You were vending.
Yeah, I was at the event. I was working. I was as a judge or doing something. I don't even remember now.
Well, Pro Tours were also open events
back then. Yeah,
like streaming didn't exist in 1996.
You could just
there
go.
Was an there was an audio stream of the Pro Tour in 1996.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I didn't know that was even capable in 96.
Yeah,
that's impressive. It was high tech.
Yeah.
So let me ask you. So in observing it then, and then obviously becoming pretty much the premier voice in Magic coverage over the last 20 years. When you like look at the way people are qualifying now and RPTQs and all this and everything that's happened in between, right? Like, would you compare Pro Tour qualification in 96 to now as like apples and oranges, or like apples and the moon? Like, is it just not even the same?
What do you think the process was for qualifying for the first Pro Tour?
Invitations, maybe.
You think it was, I think I read that, wasn't it? You had to get invited.
You had to call.
That's it.
There was a call-in number. There was a small handful of people who were pre-invited.
Right.
But for the most part, you just had to call. And for the juniors, I mean, for the seniors division, that filled up in like hours, right? Like they had a limited number of seats and it was gone. But if you were under the age of like 18, I think it was, whatever the juniors cutoff age was, people were able to call in for months to get a spot for that.
Well, because juniors, it's obviously still an initiative by Wizards, but I mean, that used to be a much, much, much bigger thing, because a lot of the guys that are pros now started as juniors, right? They were kids, like at the beginning.
Yeah, there's no division for that anymore. But yeah, I think when they first started the Pro Tour, they were a little worried about the idea that like maybe the kids couldn't, you know, run with the big boys there.
Which we've since learned is nonsense.
Well, you know, the kids who were in the juniors division were Brian Kibler, Bob Maher, John Finkel, Steve O'Mahony Schwartz, Patrick Chapin.
I've never heard of any of those people.
That's crazy.
Yeah, you're gonna more likely find names that you recognize from the juniors Pro Tour 1 than you are from Pro Tour 1.
That's so cool. So, okay. So then you look at all that now, and now, you know, you're the guy who's doing the deck techs and you're the guy at the Pro Tour every year. How have you felt about witnessing this Magic coverage initiative that's happened over the last 3 or 4 years? And as like streaming has really exploded, you know, you look at esports and how huge, I mean, ESPN just launched their esports division. Like, sort of what's your feeling on all that, the future of Magic and all that? How do you feel about it?
I mean, it's super exciting, right? Like, I think that the coverage has just grown leaps and bounds at the Pro Tour level. I mean, it's like, you know, a TV show, right? It's like watching, to me, I mean, like watching, you know, network television of a sporting event.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty insane. You know, there's probably a disconnect, right, where the GPs just have not had the same level of resources that we get at the Pro Tour. I would love to get every event up to that sort of, like, you know, multiple cameras and, you know, we've got a crew and we've got a sound guy and we've got a, you know, we've got a producer back there making graphics and, you know, three studios, like, you know,
yeah.
But it's actually just been, it's been insane. It's been really crazy to be a part of. And when we hear about how many people are watching it, it's, you know, pretty staggering, sort of the number of unique people that will go through the coverage over the course of a weekend. It's pretty, you know, amazing to be a part of.
Now, did I hear correctly? And maybe I don't know if you have the statistic in front of you, but GP Vegas, there was something like 1 million people streaming it over the course of the weekend. Is that true?
I mean, I believe you. I was at a wedding for GP Vegas.
Okay.
I missed that weekend. So I've like just blanked out. It was an open bar. It was an open bar at the wedding. And I was just slamming top shelf bourbon the whole time. And I don't remember anything. And I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Gotcha. Okay. Fair enough. So I think if we continue telling magic stories, we will cut into our exciting next segment.
I know. And it's already like, normally this is our longest segment and it's going to be extra long because we now have three lists. So I guess with Jimmy, he had the commander list to compete. So
right.
For those who don't know and didn't read the title, and this is just like on their RSS feed and they don't even know what we're about to talk about. Today we're giving out our top 10 Oath of the Gate watch cards for modern lists.
Yeah, and it's exciting because we have Alex and my opinion, but then we also have the opinion of someone who's going to be there interviewing the pros and actually talking about these cards. And if one of these cards we mentioned makes a huge impact on the Pro Tour, he's going to be directly asking the pro, why'd you put this in your deck? This happened to be on my list.
Yeah.
This is really this is a big one. And I promise you, Grand Architect won't be on the list, guys. You can think about it. It's not going to make it.
though, for those who don't know and want to talk and think our lists were bad or wrong or how did we not include their favorite pet card, we have a Twitter. It is at TheMMCast. It is the best way to reach us. We also have a Facebook and other things that you can find using the Masters of Modern name, but Twitter is probably where you'll get the quickest response. Let's get into the lists. Starting with number 10.
BDM, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I've got a couple of my cards are sort of like home run derby swings. You know, I'm hoping for something really exciting here.
Okay.
And one of those cards is Seagate Wreckage.
Okay, yeah, just missed my list in the end.
This is my number 10 card. I think I can see a home for it kind of immediately.
In Affinity?
No, not even. Well, Affinity is certainly one of those places, but I think it's a little tighter there. I could actually see it in the, the Zach Elsick crazy
lantern deck.
Contraption deck. Yeah, like the crazy lantern deck where you always know what that card's going to be that you draw. You're like, well, I could just draw and play this right now. Okay, you want to be empty-handed anyway.
Right.
But you also want more velocity to dig through your deck. I could see like, you know, maybe one copy of Seagate Wreckage, maybe more even, I don't know. But I could see it having a place in Modern.
Right.
You know, that's kind of my optimism.
And so for those who don't know, Seagate Wreckage is a land. It taps for a colorless mana, and you can tap two and a colorless mana to draw a card, and you can only activate this ability if you have no cards in hand. It's kind of a reverse Library of Alexandria. I definitely think the Lantern decks, I think also 8 Post is another deck that I think might look at this, because they're another deck that tries and gets Hellbent as soon as possible.
Right.
Sure.
It's definitely in my honorable mentions. I love that card.
I think usually if Affinity isn't winning by like turn 5 or 6, they just lose anyway. But I could see this in Affinity like as a 1-of or even possibly a 2-of just to get a little, especially in the versions that play red, to dig for a burn spell to finish it off.
Well, I think in my online I had an argument that I thought if this were to see play, it would see play in Affinity sideboards as a 1-of in case there's like in the black green matchups, because
right.
Those are always so grindy and they can kind of kill your creatures. This might let you draw an out. All right, so Ben,
oh, you want me to go next?
Yeah, you're next.
So my number 10 is a little card I like to call Slip Through Space, and it's 1 blue. It's a sorcery. It's devoid. Target creature is unblockable this turn. Draw a card. And the only reason that I put this card on my list, because there have been other cards, say like Artful Dodge or the Rebound one that gives +1/+0 and unblockable, that have done something similar. When I'm thinking about the fact that you can actually play decks like a blue-red Delver kind of a deck with like a young Pyromancer again and not just worry about dying on turn four, I don't think that this card's actually bad. Like, think about this card, playing this card alongside.
I think this card's good.
Pyromancer, playing it alongside the Prowess 1/2 with Haste for 1, Monastery Swift Spear.
Plus Storm Chaser Mage. Like, there's a bunch of good cards with. I mean, like, this.
No controversy here. I mean, like, what about just giving my Infect creature unblockable and then putting another card in my yard for Becomement?
And drawing a card,
Right.
It's one of those cards when you read it, you're like, oh, this card's just like a whatever common. How have they not printed this before? Like, how does this not exist, just not Devoid? And then you realize it doesn't, and you're like, oh, this might just be really good. So that's what I think. What do you got, Kes?
So mine's definitely a lot sillier than that. I think you put that too low almost. Kazool's Troll Collector.
Ooh,
combo enabler.
So Kazool's Troll Collector is a 2 and a red for an Ogre Warrior. He is a 3/2. He has the ability of 0, attach target equipment you control to Kazool's Troll Collector. You can only activate this ability anytime you could cast a sorcery. Now, I think this is definitely a stretch, which is why it's my number 10. But something to point out is this goes not necessarily infinite, but pseudo-infinite. Storm with, what's the hammer? I'm forgetting the hammer. Sunforge.
Oh, Sunforger?
Sunforger.
Yeah. It goes, so the deal with this is you attach Sunforger to it. You have to have some combination of white and red in a denomination of 3 mana. You have to be playing 4 copies of Desperate Ritual, 4 copies of Metamorphose, 4 copies of Naya Charm, and a copy of Grapeshot. And basically, you can do 21 damage in a turn if you untap with this thing attached to Sunforger. And then you unattach it, and then you go nuts.
Like, it doesn't have to be attached. You attach it for free. You just have to have Sunforger and this in play and untap.
With, like, I think white, red, or red, white.
Yeah,
some combination of the two. But, like, there's, Chaz Andres posted about it this week, and we retweeted him. It's, like, pretty hilarious. I mean, if you consider that all those cards have to be in your deck, same with the Troll Collectors and the Sunforgers, your deck pretty much is just like the whole deck.
Let's see if I could figure out a different deck with the Desperate Rituals and the Metamorphoses and the Grapeshot.
This is the only way to make it work.
Don't there's no chance that like both we and also Patrick Chapin won't try to make this work somehow. He'll try it. He'll definitely proxy it up. Maybe he won't use it, but he'll try it.
I'll give $10 to any person who top eights the Pro Tour with this in the deck.
Yeah, amazing.
Is this the budget seance?
Yeah, this is budget seance, and I'm also putting riders on it. It's not like if you play it at the Pro Tour. All right, number 9.
Yeah, what you got? BM.
Oh, you want to start with me? I'm sorry, Reckless Bushwhacker.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Interesting.
I'm thinking about like just you know really like. We've seen this card in other forms. Where I'm just wondering if there's just maybe enough critical mass of goblins or you know Boros token makers that you can suddenly you know really just you know create some swarmish deck that will kill your opponent.
Right, in a goblins deck, I mean that curve is so low and is missing some pieces. Maybe this is the piece, we don't know yet, but I definitely can see it being a thing.
Yeah, and that you know that ability on turn 4 to be able to go, you know, Dragon Fodder and Reckless Bushwhacker, you know, with the surge cost and you know, suddenly you're getting in for attacking for like 15 or something and you've done some damage over the first couple turns as well.
Well, plus it does synergize because it's kind of the second 8 of Goblin Bushwhacker. So like maybe having 8 of that effect makes it so you can really lean on that as being your game plan and you can kind of get somewhere with it.
Yeah. That's it. I was like, is there a critical mass of, you know, these little, you know, of these sort of temporary anthem red creatures.
Okay. And for those who don't know, this is the card, this is the goblin that you can surge. I don't know what its actual converted mana cost is, but you can surge for one.
Its actual converted mana cost is R2.
Okay, and its
surge cost is R1.
And then what it does is when it enters the battlefield, all creatures you control get +1/+0 in haste.
It should be noted that basically, like any, so we're all gonna make our predictions here, and it's gonna be interesting. But like, Modern is a format that preys upon people not realizing how powerful playing lots of spells for really cheap that get you incremental advantage are. And Surge is an ability built upon getting advantage off of playing incremental spells that get you a little bit of advantage. So we might go. This might be a situation where like we always talk about it. That one Pro Tour where all the guys came out playing Niv-Magus Elemental. And we were all like, what the hell is going on? Like, how did we not all catch this? And it's like, somebody might just have some weird surge deck that's just like, you know, I mean, I'm excited. Like, that's definitely one of the things that I'm pumped up about.
All right, so what's your number nine?
All right, so this I went with Dimensional Infiltrator, and this is a stretch.
I don't even know what that card is.
Yeah, yeah, so it's one blue, one colorless, devoid, flash flying, 2/1, blue Eldrazi drone creature, and it's not blue; it's just blue casting cost.
Okay,
and it has that weird ability for a colorless and one. You can exile a top card of target opponent's library if it's a land card. You may bounce this guy to your hand. So the only reason this guy's
really?
On the list, what
that guy?
I'll tell you why though.
Okay.
Okay, so everybody that's ever played blue knows the power of playing land, playing second land, sitting back on 2-mana counterspell, pass the turn, right? And decks that have done that have played Snapcaster Mage. And sometimes those decks flash in Snapcaster as a beatdown card. They don't want to, but they do sometimes. The point of this card is they've never printed this rate before. 2-1 flying flash for in blue. Like, this on curve with a mana leak or a remand has never been printed. So I'm not saying it's going to break the format, but when you consider, like, same thing with like a blue-red Delver deck. This is a card that should have existed and hasn't. And I'm just saying it gives something like this a bit more flexibility. Obviously, you don't want to run it into like a, you know, Lingering Souls or something like that. But if Welkin Turn had flash, people might have considered it for standard or for modern play at some point. You just don't know. It's innocuously powerful, and I'm curious to see. What do you guys
think? And the last line of text is, you think, is just like a red herring or a colorless herring?
I don't even pay attention to that. Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it does allow it to be vaguely, like, sometimes it'll dodge the removal spell.
Yeah, like, it can, right, if you need it to. Like, so if it's, you know, later in the game, if you guys are top decking or something and they go to remove it, you're going to kill them. Like, that's fine. But for me, mostly, it's just, it's pretty freaking aggressive. Like, it's pretty aggressive. And I'm just saying, like, what blue player doesn't want 2 power flying on turn 2 to come down end of turn? Like, that sounds really good to me. So,
okay,
just my opinion.
So my number 9 is, this is a little bit more legit than my number 10. Warping Whale. Okay. This is the Eldrazi charm for all intents and purposes. One colorless, one generic instant. You choose one. You can exile target creature with power or toughness 1 or less. Counter target sorcery spell or put a 1/1 colorless Eldrazi Scion creature into play. And it, you know, can be sacrificed for a mana. I mean, like, in general, the fact that it just... like, there are so many X1s or 1Xs that in the format that this hits so many different creatures. And not to mention that, like, walking in this format, like, countering Scapeshift is something I want to be able to do right now.
You've just stolen my whole number 6 here.
Oh, yeah. That'll happen. It happens all around. You'll probably steal some of my early ones.
It probably happens more frequently as we go up the list.
Yes, it definitely does.
The reason this card didn't make my list, just for the record, is... so the most important ability is the exile ability, and that's because Vryn's Prodigy has zero power. Like, Vryn's Prodigy, Vendilion Click...
Bob,
yeah, there's like a few that are like very played.
Deceiver so, XR, I mean. Yeah.
So those.
I was just gonna say it went down a little bit after.
Yeah,
Deceiver.
Well, that's why it's my number 9 now. If Splinter Toon wasn't banned, this would be probably in my top 5. But now that that's no longer in the format, it definitely loses some of its importance in the format.
Countering a sorcery is fine. Like, even mid game, just countering someone's Serum Visions is not the worst thing if this thing's stranded in your hand. But the real issue is that, like, when it is stranded in your hand from the beginning of the game and you don't hit one of those targets and you basically just have a 1/1 token for 2 in your hand to like turn 6, Modern's such a powerful format that even though this card's versatile, it's just a really bad ability.
No, but if on turn 2 they don't do anything and you have this in your hand and you have a force drop spell, you can flash this at the end of the turn and ramp for that turn to play like Olivia. I mean, I'm not saying Jund is the one playing this, but Olivia you could put into play, or... Master of Waves out of Merfolk, and Merfolk definitely could see this playing this card. Like, there's definitely, like, ramping from 2 to 4, even for just one turn, is still a pretty big play in this format.
Yeah, you could be right. It was like number 13 for me. It just didn't quite crack the top 10, but Dimensional Infiltrator did.
Yes. <yeah. laughs> All right, so let's mix it up, Ben. Why don't we hear your number 8?
Okay, my number 8 is Hissing Quagmire. This is the black green man land that becomes a 2/3. With Death Touch for a green, a black, and a colorless. It's 2/2 Death Touch, right? 2/2?
Yeah.
2/2, I said 2/3. I think it's pretty self-explanatory here. I mean, this is a Jund card going into a deck that plays manlands. The only question is, what manlands does this card replace? You know, it's like, Treetop Village is really, really good, but it only gives you green mana. So maybe one treetop becomes this. I don't really know. Like, the, what does the deck normally play? Like, six man lands? Well, being like able that?
To play, like, blue, black, green are the two colors that are important, that deck. It's always splashing the red or splashing right. the white. So that's definitely important. BDM, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think those lands are just all going to find their, just going to sort of, to me, unexcitedly find their way into their decks. I think all the lands that are in all the creature lands in the set will find a home.
Just because, like, at the end of the day, even just having one, it's a dual land that can be a creature. Like, worst case scenario, and the only thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm with you. Absolutely.
I mean, I think like the, you know, the. I don't remember all the names of them still yet. I still got a few days before I get to Vancouver. You know, Needle Spires is like just you know, a card that if there's a Naya deck out there, or you're able to just like kill people out of nowhere with that card. Wandering Fumarole is just gonna, like, I think, you know, goes right into the, you know, the derelict building that used to be Splinter Twin. Right, like that deck doesn't actually go away, right?
Right,
like,
right.
It's still this like blue, white, red value control deck.
Right.
That just needs to find a way to finish you off. And now it's like, okay, well, we're down to this point where I have this overwhelming hand advantage. You're just kind of gasping for cards off the top of your deck every turn, and I'm just gonna bash in for four with my Wandering Fumarole every turn.
Yeah, I mean we were arguing like this on the cast before, but like I could see it as a possibility. It's just the activation is so expensive is the only thing. And I get that, like,
it's four. But like the point is, like, people are playing Celestial Colonnade
exactly.
at five mana. And yeah. like not every deck has white. This is the blue red version of that. It bashes in for the same amount of damage. Eventually your opponent doesn't have cards in hand. So it definitely does a lot of work there. I think also like the Grixis control decks where some of them are playing Liliana, eventually you get it so they literally don't have cards in hand and you can just free roll, start hitting them for four. And this is lightning bolt resistant in the early game. It's good at blocking versus something like Creeping Tar Pit.
Yeah.
Or
Treetop Village even, right? It doesn't get lightning bolted.
Right.
Well, you can't block.
You can choose not to let it get lightning bolted anyway.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, they're like, I'm not saying it's horrible. It just didn't occur to me as a home run, but you know.
So these are my number sixes. I'm going to save my one little point with Hissing Quagmire for when we get to number six. But yeah, let's. Okay.
I just had all three lands in like the honorable mention section because I just think they're just going to find their way in, but I don't think that they're, you know,
something to write home about.
I'm more excited about them than I sound, but I'm just saying, you know what I mean. I feel like they're not. The sexy part of Modern that we want to talk about.
Right. Sure, fair enough. All right, so what's your number eight?
All right, this one's, again, and after this, I swear they get a little more conventional. Inverter of Truth.
You went with Inverter? But how?
I went with Inverter of Truth.
All right, please break it down for everybody.
I will tell you what Inverter of Truth does. Inverter of Truth is 2BB for a creature Eldrazi. It's a mythic rare. It's a 6/6 flyer, and it's devoid.
And it has one other important line of text.
it does have another important line of text.
It's four lines.
When Inverter Truth enters battlefield, exile all cards from your library face down, then shuffle all cards from your graveyard into your library.
So talk about why you think this is good, but I do have a funny story with this card once you're done.
I think it's just an exciting card. You think about like the Grisly Salvages and the Mulches. And the even the Corpse Churn, which is a new card in this set, like that are available to you to, you know, sort of start digging through your library, right? Get that kind of velocity going on right. your cards. And then, you know, even like, let's just imagine a Corpse Churn, right? At the end of, you know, it's like, you know, you've thought scoured yourself and you've done something else, you know, Grisly Salvaged on turn two, and then you pass the turn and the end of turn three, you Corpse Churn, you put three cards into your graveyard, and there's an Inverter of Truth. You pick it up with the Corpse Churn, you untap, and you just slam down this 6/6 flyer, and now you have this little curated graveyard. Maybe there's another Inverter of Truth in there. Like, you can just keep it going, and it's just this. It's just this kind of cool high pressure card. And, you know, assuming you have like Thought Seizes and Inquisition of Kozilek's in there. You know, you have some sort of ability to attack your opponent's hand and to sort of know that those cards are going to come back with a pretty high rate once you've played the inverter, so you can sort of keep your opponent at bay. I don't know. It's just an interesting card to me. It's an exciting card to me, and it's the kind of deck I like playing.
Is it the kind of card that you think could go into like the Grixis deck as a one of, like, so maybe a little mid game because they just loot and play?
I think that there's probably a home for it as a weird, like almost like creature based Gaea's Blessing, right? Like where you're saying, like, I'm just gonna dig through, I'm gonna have all these good cards, all this exciting stuff's gonna happen, and then I'm just gonna, all those cards are gonna, you know, just become my deck. I'm just gonna draw good stuff. I'm gonna draw counter spells, and I'm gonna draw, you know, Cruel Ultimatum. I'm gonna draw whatever from this point on, and then I'm just gonna finish you off with this. I think there's a lot of different ways you can go with the card.
Well, because it pairs really, really well with A, Looters with Jace is amazing, and it also pairs really well with cards that delve. So when you delve away all of the things that you don't want to redraw, and then you reshuffle all the things you do want to redraw into your deck, and then all of a sudden your deck is just like 9 gas spells. Seems pretty sweet. I don't know. My only question is, Abyssal Persecutor has never been like a modern card that was good. I mean, it's once or twice. Now, that's also because it's a 4-mana sorcery speed card, and Splinter Twin used to exist. So you wonder, would Abyssal Persecutor have possibly been on someone's radar now anyway?
Play now, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, this might be kind of the same thing.
So my only good story with this card is that I traveled to Hong Kong for work, and it was before the actual spoilers were in the app we use, so I just knew what the card was called, and like I like had read it once. I was like, oh, it does something cool, but I read it as Inverted Truth enters the battlefield, exile cards from your library, then shuffle your cards from your graveyard into your library, and then put all of those cards exiled from your library into your graveyard. And so spent a good 15-hour plane ride brewing a really sweet deck that got all Vengevines into the graveyard and combo killed someone on turn 4, and then I landed, and then I looked, and I was like, oh, that was a waste of time.
Yeah, well,
my good story
I would
was...
I would play the hell out of that card.
Our buddy
that
Tone...
That card would be at least a 5 on my list.
Our buddy Tone during pre-release weekend was just like had a couple too many drinks and was betting us just blind amounts of money, like, I'm going to win this tournament, I'm going to beat you guys, we're doing a little pre-release at home. He's like, I'm going to win, and then he played that card and just exiled his entire... Didn't even realize what it did. And just proceeded to just lose the game. He had no cards in his graveyard. Which is pretty fantastic.
All right, so my number 8 is once again a pretty decent card, I think. Kozilek's Return.
Yeah. Oh, only number 8, really?
Yeah, this is 2 in a red. This is the instant, does 2 damage to each creature, devoid spell that whenever you cast an Eldrazi creature spell with converted mana cost 7 or greater, you may exile it and do 5 damage to each creature. So
when would you ever cast a 7-drop Eldrazi spell in Modern? Come on.
Ulamog! And that's the same deck that you can then tutor for your Kozilek with Ancient Stirrings.
I just can't believe that this card is so low for you.
I'm a little less high than other people on this card. I do think 3 mana, even at instant speed, is very different than 2 mana, especially for Tron decks.
Right.
Like, Pyroclasm on turn 2 is useful because they're not really doing anything on turn 2. Turn 3 is when they're dropping... You know,
Oblivion Stone,
Karn, or
things that matter.
Things that matter.
Yeah, no, I get you. I just like for me, like when you consider all the cards we're gonna talk about on this list, almost every single card on here is from a place of speculation. Whereas like this card is almost 100% gonna be possibly a 4 of in probably the best deck or most played deck at the Pro Tour, or at least the front runner.
I also don't think Tron's gonna be the best deck in the Pro Tour. That's a different preview because like. I mean, and Cedric Phillips did a really good article last Friday on this, but Tron is terrible in formats where Affinity, Infect, are going to show up and Burn are going to show up in force, and the Pro Tour is the one tournament where Affinity, Infect, and Burn show up in force.
Yeah, well, we'll see. So that was who's number 8 was that? Was it yours?
That was mine.
Okay, so now we're on number 7.
Yeah, we're going to get to that card, I think, a few more times. So yeah, let's move on. Brian, you want to do your number 7?
Did you both do your number 8s?
Yes. Mine was Kozilek Return, and Ben did.
So my number 7's Overwhelming Denial.
Oh, you went with it. So it just barely skipped mine. And so explain what you're thinking.
I have Kozilek Return out just on my outside list.
Oh,
in the same place. Just cuz I feel like yes, there's a place for it, but I'm curious if there's necessarily going to be a job for it.
Right.
If you know what I'm saying, like, I think, but Overwhelming Denial is just like, we've seen, you know, like Counterflux and those types of counter spells get into Modern even, right? Like we saw that in Sean McLaren's sideboard when he won the Pro Tour.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the Counterflux has always been, and Counterflux in Scapeshift decks especially has always been extremely well placed on curve, because once you get to 7, that's exactly what you want anyway.
And so this is almost strictly better in Scapeshift because of the fact that, like, the point is in Scapeshift, you're countering the spells after you cast Scapeshift. So you've got that surge job down to start countering spells
spells. This is an uncounterable counter at 2 mana if you're doing 2 things in 1 turn.
Yeah, I mean, I was listening to Chapin and Flores on Top Level this week, and they were talking about it a little bit, and they were saying how it's interesting in that sense, but it's also interesting if you just think about, like, what if you just play this deck in a deck with, like, some, you know, cheap or free instance? Like, what if you just play this in a deck with, like, Mana Morphos? Like, some kind of a tempo deck, and this card's in there with Mana Morphos and, like, Gutshots and things like that. It's like, really, how bad is it to Mana Morphos into blue-blue counterspell? Or, like, how bad is it really to just, like, Gutshot and then just have blue-blue counterspell? If you can get that, like, I thought it was kind of an interesting point he made, which is that this is not just counterspell, which is way too powerful for Modern, but it's an uncounterable counterspell.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's the big Lord Man, right? And you can still do things like, in Modern, you know, your opponent casts something, you're like, okay, in response, I'm going to Lightning Bolt that, and then I'm going to uncounterably counter this on 3 mana.
So speaking of 2 spells in 1 turn, I'm gonna jump to my card now, unless Cassie wanted to throw something on the fire there. Jory N. Ruin Diver is my number 7.
Oh, you put that guy on your list.
Yeah, and this one's probably like...
I mean, he's a pretty decent value engine.
Yeah, this one's probably a little bit more like, this is a card that I really want to be good. It just seems so awesome.
So for those who don't know, Jory N. Ruin Diver is 1 blue red. He is a legendary creature, Merfolk Wizard. Whenever you cast your second spell each turn, draw a card, and he's a 2/3.
So yeah, the reason this card's awesome, I mean, it's pretty obvious. You're playing in a format that plays Gitaxian Probe, first of all. So, like, on turn 3, you just play this guy, pay 2 life, and then draw a card. So, like, right off the bat, like, there's cards in the format that are just... I mean, you could even, if you're playing a deck with this guy, you could even play Noxious Revival in your main deck just to do it, just because, like, why not? Like, you just get back a fetch land and then just draw the fetch land. Like, it doesn't even matter. You're still getting value as long as you can play free spells.
Well, plus, I mean,
that seems super sweet to me, actually.
Yeah,
that
right?
That seems super sweet.
Like, the Abbott decks. Like, there are already decks that are playing, like, quad Gitaxian Probe, quad...
Mishra's Bauble,
just because they're playing Abbot of Carrollkeep and they want to be able to just exile that top card and play it on turn 2. Like, I definitely can see that kind of scene playing those decks.
The sweetest use of this card that I've heard is people talking about this gives Merfolk a real reason to splash red, which, like, is pretty... We've heard, like, Merfolk splashes X for value. Like, I went to that PTQ over the summer and, like, jammed Collected Company into my Merfolk deck. It, like, wasn't good. But, I mean, this just seems sweet because it's like, you're going to probably play it, and the turn you play it, it's more than likely going to be a 3/4. So, like, that means the turn you play it, they're either going to kill the Lord that's already in play, but they can't just kill this thing. And then, like, every turn after that, you just have the possibility of drawing these, like, dinky little 2-drops, probably a creature and a Vapor Snag turns into a card. You can splash Lightning Bolt. That seems awesome, too, but maybe just complicates the deck.
My one large amount of haterade for this card, and there's some, A, in Merfolk specifically, anything with Aether Vial seems really bad with this card.
Yeah, true.
B, Lightning Bolt, just in general, it doesn't pass Lightning Bolt tests. But the one comment I do have about it that does make it interesting is, before Splinter Twin was banned, I wouldn't even consider this card.
Exactly.
But now that it's gone, a Sorcerer Speed 2/3 that for 3 that, like, immediately draws you a card, becomes a much more interesting beast of a card.
Yeah, no, it's certainly interesting. All right, who's next?
I think I'm number 7. So my number 7, the big daddy of this set, Mr. Kozilek, the Great Distortion.
Interesting. I did get another card. It didn't make my list.
So he is 8 diamond for a legendary creature Eldrazi. When you cast Kozilek, the Great Distortion, if you have fewer than 7 cards in your hand, you draw cards equal to that difference. It has menace. And then you can discard a card with converted mana cost X to counter target spell with converted mana cost X, and it is a 12/12. So I think this will probably see at most as a 2 of in Tron lists or other big mana lists. But the reason I like him is that deck often can run out of cards, and he helps fix that problem. He also kind of just locks out opponents. If you look at that list, the actual converted mana cost, like, spread in Tron is pretty wide.
Yeah, I mean, that seems...
It's mostly 1-2 drops, and then there's 6 and 7 drops. But I do think this is a card that we'll see play. He's awesome. Yeah, I'm a fan.
What do you think, BDM?
I have him like kind of like 11th, 12th in my list. I mean, I think there's a lot of other, giant scary spaghetti monsters that people are going to want to play. I think, you know, he's fighting for it. So I kind of had him on the outside looking in on my top 10, but sure. I fully expect to see this card in play, early into the constructed rounds of the Pro Tour.
Right, like one of, two of. I don't think it's any more of that. I think he's comparable to kind of what Emrakul was seeing play in Tron lists, and maybe a lot, one of each. But I definitely think he does very interesting things. The fact that he draws card is the more important thing, and then the fact that he can lock your opponent out of the game at times. It's definitely an interesting card. All right, so round 6. BDM, go ahead.
I have Warping Whale here. Okay. So it's a card we've already talked about, and it's really like, expressed all the stuff that, you know, I feel like it does. And I think even making that 1-1 guy, sometimes, you know, you talked about that idea of like, you know, ambushing a Snapcaster Mage late in the game is probably going to be fine sometimes.
Right, 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 right.
Or even just exiling Snapcaster
Mage. Or you could just exile it. Sure, that's also true. But
Sometimes you cast a 1-1 on turn 2 in like a counterspell war matchup where nothing's going to get played, and then just that one damage starts chipping away at them.
I mean, it's certainly not.
I think this is a card that just is a nice little, like, a nice little utility thing, a utility, you know, knife. It's a scissor. It's a knife. It's a screwdriver. It, you know, turns into a magnet. It's got a flashlight on it.
It does. It should be noted. Now, I know we've all talked about this a little bit, but generating colorless mana is not just like a given. Like, it's being able to play this on turn 2 means that you probably aren't playing a mana base with just like 2 fetch lands for shocks. Like, that's probably not what you're getting. So your mana base changes and maybe becomes a bit more painful. You know what I mean?
Like, I don't think it becomes more painful. I think you start paying filter lands, or you play pain lands, which does make it more painful. But I think there's definitely lands out there that encourage that you can tap for colorless that this would just encourage you to play with instead.
Agreed, but like, I don't know if you've ever had the thing happen to you where you play a deck with even 3 filter lands in it that plays multiple colors, and you just happen to keep a draw 2 lander with 2 filter lands in it, and you're like,
but I'm definitely playing a blue white dead that has like 2 ghost quarter, 1 filter land, and one of the like the looter lands, or like in junk, yeah, I have like 2 to 4 +1/+1 counter, like Gavinning Township.
You're still
like,
talking about 3 or 4 sources for a card that, what if it's in your hand and you don't draw one of the sources? It's just a dead card. That's really bad.
I think the card probably shines more in a deck, like, you know, if there's a spot for it in the sideboard of Affinity.
Right. Yeah.
Which has so many colorless lands, or even in the Infect decks, which have, you know, colorless all, lands, you know, yeah. You know, have some, you know, lands that are, you
the
know,
man lands
creatures.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's something that you can slap into every deck, but I think that the decks, there are going to be decks that can support it. And, or even, you know, even you're talking about like Tron decks, or you're talking about, Eldrazi decks, which I think are both going to be, you know, pretty reasonable presences at this modern Pro Tour. And, they can cast this card very easily if there's something that they really feel like they need to deal with.
Like, out of a sideboard for Affinity, you mentioned that, like, a lot of the worst cards for Affinity are sorceries.
Yeah, I mean, countering some sort of a Wrath effect.
Like Shatterstorm or...
Yeah, also countering some sort of a Wrath effect, or also being able to, like, counter a Hand Disruption spell mid-game in some cases. Like, there are applications. Like I said, Serum Visions is one of the most played cards in the entire format. And there are some games where somebody playing a Serum Visions mid-game is going to be the thing that pushes them into position to beat you in top deck mode. And having this card stranded in your hand from the beginning of the game is not the worst thing if that's the case. Like, it still gives you a leg up in that mid game. So,
and
you know,
kudos to you if you were able to not just cash it in for a 1-1 while you're waiting for your opponent to draw Serum Visions there.
I mean, think about this card against blue red decks. Like, blue red decks, the velocity going through the deck is so fast that definitely countering a Serum Visions in one of those decks is a relevant thing to be doing.
Great. All right, so I'm going to do my number 6, which have also been called before this point, so I'm hoping Ben has a surprise number 6 placement, but maybe he doesn't. Mine are the two manlands, Hissing Quagmire and Wandering Fumarole. I guess theoretically the red white one also is decent. I didn't include that because I do think it's the worst of the three. The one point that we didn't really talk about, I do want to bring out with Hissing Quagmire, is that this is the best defensive one of almost all of these manlands, I think, in all, like, in the full 10, because it is really hard to attack into opponent with open mana with a Tarmogoyf if they just have this land in front of them towards the mid to late game. Just the threat that you're just going to, it's just going to die for three mana is so large that I think it really gives a good defensive stance to decks that are playing green black that they didn't have before.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's, I think the man lands, BDM, you put it best. Like, they're going to end up in all the decks just by virtue of that they're new good man lands. Like, they're not bad. You know what I mean? Like, what? they're good enough. So, I mean, some of the man lands that are borderline haven't made it, but the ones that produce two colors, it's hard. It's really hard to argue against.
Well,
I mean,
it's like why you go to Denny's, right? They're open.
Yeah. I'll agree to that. All right. So, Ben, you're number six.
My Don't number let us down. Six is Matter Reshaper.
Ooh.
Yeah. This card. Now, I don't know. I don't really know, like, where I think this card necessarily fits into the format, but playing it in, I had two copies of it in one of my sealed pools at the pre-release, and I was just blown away by the power level. Like, it's a very deceptively powerful card. I mean, it doesn't. 3/3 is fine, and in this format, 3 toughness is like not something you really want to have coming down.
Well, but it's lightning proof in the sense that it kind of replaces itself.
Totally replaces itself. Yeah. Either gets you a land or a permanent in the right deck. You'll always get a land or a creature or draw a card. I mean, like, what if there was just a? I mean, if there was just a 3/3 that said, like, if this card dies, you look at the top card, have the choice of putting a creature into play or drawing a card, like. I mean, if that card had been printed, I think it's something we would have talked about at this point. That's what this is. So I'm a little surprised.
Well, this card compares very favorably to both Coiling Oracle and Solemn Simulacrum.
Exactly.
Agreed.
100%. I mean, and when you think about like value 3 drops that have existed that people play, cards like Kitchen Finks, I mean, this is sort of, it's sort of in the same boat, but it's like, it's just aggressive. And I mean, it's just great. I don't know. I think this card's really good. I don't know where it fits, though, is the only issue. But it is really good, though.
It's going to go into most of my commander decks. I can tell you that.
I mean, it probably goes into the Eldrazi decks people are building, right? I mean, you can't cast it off of colorless, but like they're already doing the Urborg package, and it already plays black in a lot of those decks. So I've heard of mono black. I've heard of black white. So I don't mind the idea. Like, you can get this on turn 2 and it looks like the Eye of Ugin Urborg deal. Like, you can also just like Eldrazi Temple and a swamp gets this thing to play on turn 2. And I've heard a 3/3 on turn 2 that replaces itself or draws you a card is pretty darn good in modern.
Yeah, no, yeah. I think you're good job. Good job not letting us down with picking a card that we hadn't heard before that's like decent as well.
Yeah, I think Reshaper's
pretty
sweet.
Happy. All right, so.
Can I just do number 5 also right now because I'm so excited about it?
Yeah, go for
it. I want no one else to say it before me.
Yeah.
Reality Smasher.
Oh.
Am I the only one that went with Reality Smasher?
Mine's way higher. Or not way higher, but mine's higher.
Okay.
It's
so sweet. Reality Smasher, the more I've looked at the set and the more I've thought about it, it might just be pound for pound the sweetest card in the set by like a mile. Like
Describe it to us.
So it costs 1 colorless mana plus 4 generic. It is a 5/5 trample haste Eldrazi creature that if a spell... It's a spell, right? Not a spell or ability.
Whenever Reality Smasher becomes the target of a spell, an opponent controls, counter that spell unless its controller discards a card.
Okay, so yeah, like it's it rumbles pretty hard against like Tassigers and Sea Rhinos. Like it's a 5/5, which is already just an insane rate. The trample and haste as a 5/5 for 5 is like very, very powerful. And then the fact that it's gonna 2-for-1 them, and a lot of the times in modern, if you're playing some sort of a grindy deck where this is like a 2-of top end finisher, and this card comes down, they won't even have 2 cards a lot of the time. A lot of the time, they'll have 1 removal spell they're sitting on. Like the other crazy thing to me about this is like, and I mean, this is another thing I heard Chapin say on the same podcast, and this is a standard thing, but what happens when you have this card in play, they untap, they draw their second card to kill this thing, they target it, and then you like flash in your Void Grafter, which like won't happen in modern, but you make it hexproof in response to them discarding
or
a card.
Indestructible or whatever other way you can make it so it doesn't
protection,
die.
Protection, like anything that just like, your opponent just scoops it up and just walks out of the room.
Just think about how bad it feels to cast Path to Exile on your opponent's creature in the first place.
Right.
No, imagine that it's like 3 cards.
Well, yeah.
The path. They discard a card and you get a land.
Right. Well, Path is one of 2 really major played removal spells in the format. It's Abrupt Decay proof. It's Lightning Bolt proof. it Terminate can kill it, and Path can kill it.
But you have to have a second card.
People are playing it. Yeah, if you have 3 cards, basically.
It's just nuts. I mean, I'm trying to think, what a card like this, if a card like this became dominant, what if Modern became a format that was ruled by who drew their Reality Smashers first? What if five drops ruled the format? Like, I guess Counterspells would just become the thing people were doing.
I would just run Thrag Tusks everywhere.
Yeah, this card, Thrag Tusk is sweet against this card.
I should be like, yeah, all right, we're in the land of five drops, Thrag Tusk, deal with this.
Do I need to discard a card if I block it with my Thrag Tusk? No? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet, do I still get a token? Awesome.
Speaking of Thrag Tusk, so BDM, last week on the show, Kessler and I did our top 10 cards most likely to see Modern since the ban of Splinter Twin. And then at the end of the shows often, we'll do this little Royal Rumble where we each choose one off-the-beaten-path card that wasn't on our list, and we fight them. We get 30 seconds to pitch the audience. The audience votes on Twitter, and whoever loses buys a dinner for the opponent.
I'm so far 3-0 on dinners.
It's because I choose cooler cards than you. They're just not as competitive.
That's not what the winning says.
But this last week was very competitive. It was 2-2, and then the one he won on was Thrag Tusk somehow got a 54% vote versus Koth of the Hammer as cards that would more be cooler to see, more interesting.
Which I was surprised, because that was my throwaway last one. And it's also
180 votes.
I figured Thrag Tusk in general would have a little bit more of a stigma of hatred based off of
standard,
because it was a standard menace. It's the same reason people didn't Bitter Blossom for years, because it was oh, that sucked playing against that. But nope, Thrag Tusk rocked it.
People just don't know how
people
sweet
love
Koth
five
is.
Drops. That's why Reality Smasher is sweet. Bring it back.
So sweet. Reality Smasher is incredible. And I guess this just goes right along with that Eldrazi deck. That Eldrazi deck that was already fringe, that people were already scared of. The printing of this and one other card that I'm sure we'll all talk about is just, it's kind of mind melting. It's sort of hard to believe that the two cards that good are both getting introduced to the format.
I think the Eldrazi deck is going to be really good. And in fact, I think anything that is graveyard related is probably the worst possible choice you could play for this
Pro Tour.
For this Pro Tour, just because you're going to see so many, Bajuka Bogs and things like that, where people just want to exile your graveyard so that they can Oblivion Sower your lands and, all sorts of, I just think it's going to be a bad graveyard Pro Tour.
Yeah, agreed.
So what do you guys got for your number five?
I've got Nissa, Voice of Zendikar.
You went with Nissa for Modern. Interesting. I cut it because I was trying to figure out what deck it went into.
That's, you know what? I was also trying to figure out what deck it was going to, and then ultimately I just decided it is a three-drop Planeswalker that does things.
That protects itself.
Right.
It protects itself. You get to do stuff in Elfy decks. You get to, it's
roll
just going to be.
As the three-drop you play turn one, Nacodle, turn two, put either a two drop or 2-1 drops into play, and then this, you pump all the first three creatures you played and they get in there. That's a pretty big.
And then they have to decide if they kill Nissa or start picking off your creatures, and if they wrath the board, you still have a Nissa.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for me. I thought about it there. I also thought about it as an interesting card to try to stick a few copies into Scapeshift, just as I'm going to start plussing this thing up and just making tokens, and then if you don't do anything and this game goes too long, I'll just make all my tokens bigger and attack and just start making more tokens. I don't know. It's it doesn't really do a whole lot in the deck, but if you could reconfigure that deck to make Nissa work in it, it's not the worst thing.
And any deck that can also make use of that 0/1. If you can somehow pump the 0/1 into a bigger creature, I can definitely see if you have an equipment or you have, any type of other planeswalker that pumps it, or you just whatever you have that can, or if you're playing Gavinny Township, if you're playing a green spell,
right?
It's pretty likely.
I mean, also keep in mind that putting a +1/+1 counter on a Kitchen Finks that has a -1/-1 counter on it,
real good,
is a really good thing to do, as we've seen in Modern for the last 4 years.
You also have seen those Scapeshift lists where game two they'll take out the combo and they just play value creatures like Primeval Titan and Thrag Tusk and stuff. And I can see some main deck version or some sideboard version, because they might take out all the spot removal if they don't know what they're doing, because that's what Scapeshift does. And then you play this thing, you start plussing it up, they don't know how to deal with it, and then it ultimates, and you draw nine cards all of a sudden, and you're just this value rug deck.
Three mana planeswalkers that do something are something to always look at. I think people are having acid flashbacks towards the Ajani.
Yeah, right.
And this is not that. This is a much better card.
Hey,
than
you
that.
Know, you know what? You know what? That Ajani made second place at a Pro Tour. So,
but a standard Pro Tour.
Standard Pro Tour, but
right,
I'm just
right,
saying.
Pro Tour.
I'm just saying, three mana planeswalkers will find a way. That's
right,
all
sure.
I'm saying.
And moving into my number five, this is relevant, so I'll make this point as a segue. This is also probably pretty good in junk decks alongside Oath of Nissa, allowing you to get this and Liliana out for mana saving.
That's your number five?
Yeah, that's my number five.
You don't think that Green Ponder... I'm not going to tell you where this is on my list, but we will get to it. But Green Ponder, like, you don't think that, like, in a format that is just, like... They had to ban two
it's
Ponders.
Not, that's the thing. It's not Ponder. And I think that's why I lower it, because people say it and maybe it's like a pet peeve-based thing. But Ponder is... One of the reasons Ponder is so good is because it keeps things on top. You can set up your next three turns. This
lowercase Ponder, when people refer to a card as being a Ponder, they mean it's a one-mana deck manipulation spell.
True. You get to pick
the
top
three cards.
They don't
mean that it is literally Ponder.
This is definitely a one-mana... Right.
As someone who has said Green Ponder and has taken a lot of... a crap for it.
And we could save this maybe the talk, because I have a feeling it's not both much higher on both of your lists.
I have it a little higher.
A little higher. I will say that is why it's a little lower. I do think it's really good. I do think it is a one green mana anticipate, and I think was my top card for the set that came out in anyways, so I don't have a lot of ground to stand on.
You're just forgetting that we'll talk about it a little more in a second, so let's move on to number four.
Sure, yeah. Okay. But back to my segue.
Oh, yeah.
Nissa and Liliana, same deck, hanging out. This lets you find them and get the cast both of them because of the mana fixing.
Right.
That's nice, yes. Yep. That's what that was. What that segue is about. All right, so I think we're on to number four.
Yes. Storm Chaser Mage.
Oh, I have mine higher.
Okay, yeah. I mean, this card...
That's also my number four.
Okay,
Well, perfect. All right, you guys talk. And
this card's pretty bonkers. I mean, it's like, I won't say like who, but one of the pros that we know that we were talking to a little bit had told me that his team was looking at this card a little bit. You know, it's like, I mean, obviously among like other cards, but one of the cards that was like making sense in this new deck, and it's pretty good.
Here, it's already been proven that Prowess is a very good mechanic.
Yeah.
And this card already saw some play this past weekend in Standard.
I mean, it's just good.
I think it saw play in Modern. I think there was a Teemer Delver list that did well, and I thought I saw this in it. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe that's what it is. I was relying largely on Twitter for my updates. But I think this card's great. I think that you can, you know, you have great creatures at 1, 2, and 3 in some sort of red blue prowess deck. I mean, we Dragonauts doesn't really have prowess, but you know.
Right. Well, and plus, I mean, like in reality, you can play one drop, play Serum Visions on turn one, play this on turn two, and then like just hold up mana and start just poking off creatures. It does a really good Delver Mutation, just gets in there quick. It's once again another good spell with the Gataxian Probes and Mishra's Baubles, and
yeah, exactly.
Like these are all in the kind of the same family. That yeah, it's definitely an interesting place.
You could just put Abbot of Carol Keep in the same deck, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You're talking totally. About the Abbot decks that were doing all those things.
I mean, I would say get your foil now. Like this, I mean, maybe once some more packs have been opened, it'll be, you know, it'll be a little easier. But I mean, this is one of those long term cards where it's pretty hard to imagine this card in Eternal formats not being just like always an option for people to play. So you know, at an uncommon gold card, like in a small set, I think, you know, get your foils once they go down a little bit, but I think it's going to be an expensive card long term. So,
My number four, a very different card, Goblin Dark Dwellers.
You went with Goblin Dark Dwellers that high?
So this is a 3 red Goblin Menace. When Goblin Dark Dwellers enters the battlefield, you may cast target insert a sorcery card with converted mana cost 3 or less from your graveyard without paying the mana cost. If that card would be put in your graveyard this turn, exiled instead, 4/4. So it's pseudo red Snapcaster Mage.
Right.
For a 3-drop. One of the main things that I do have it here for a 5-drop. One of the main things I do have it here for is the fact that it casts Boombust.
Right.
Which is a deck that has been doing, like, apparently through Moto testing and streaming, it's been doing actually pretty decently, and that ability is pretty strong right now, especially as we were talking about man lands or lands in general moving forward are really important at this Pro Tour. And so Boombust in general is decent, and then into this later where you just get this curve topper. I do think, we've mentioned before, 5-drops are now a thing to look at.
Right.
5-drops are no longer out of the question, I think, in this format. I think they're still problematic because you still have Infect Affinity. They're still the decks that kill you on turn four, not just blatantly kill you like Splinter Twin did. But I think a 4/4 Menace for 4 is also just kind of generally on curve. That's really aggressive as a spell.
For 5.
For 5.
Yeah, I mean, my only thing with this card, because I was talking about this card in our Highlander format we always play as a possibility, and I think it's powerful. Like, there's no doubt. You know, red doesn't really get access to an effect as powerful as this usually. But the thing is, 5 mana in Modern, even without Splinter Twin, is... it's a tall order. I mean, it's getting you a more selective version of what a Bloodbraid Elf was doing, and that card got banned. But it's also 5 instead of 4.
But it's a 4/4 difficult to block in a format where people generally don't have a bunch of creatures on the board. It doesn't die to lightning bolt.
Difficult to block, difficult to cast, right? Like, I mean,
doesn't attack turn 6. I mean, like, you have to.
Well, no, but that turn 6, you've already cast it. You gain value when it comes in. You gain a lot of value by getting a free spell.
Just playing it, yeah.
You already mentioned Boom Bust, but I mean, also there's also Molten Rain in Modern, right? Like,
yeah. Right.
You know, there have been red blue, Magnivore decks that have, you know, succeeded in past larger formats, and you know, this card, you know, becomes acidic slime in that deck, right? It becomes a 4/4.
Yeah.
You know, it becomes an acidic slime meets Endrick Stomp Howler. You know, it's 4/4/5 that just happens to take out a land or take out all the lands.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I mean, the land destruction deck in Modern has been like a thing that's talked about forever, and I was on that corner a lot over the summer trying to, when Tron was getting so big, I was trying to figure out, you know, my own boom bust strategy, because everybody's played the Flagstones of Trocare version from Standard, and then people have tried the sac lands that you can do on turn 3. I mean, there's a lot of interesting ways to try to pull it off, and so I can see where this card would fit in. It's just maybe as a 1 or 2 of, but I can't really see a deck that's playing 4. Though, I mean, it's worth more than I would have expected at this point for a card that was both was a buy a box promo and it's just a rare, right? It's worth like $4 or $5,
I think. Yeah, because it's really good. It's like, I think we'll see this card more than you guys are giving it credit.
Again, thinking about those Tron decks and thinking about those weird Eldrazi ramp decks, like if you have the ability to like really, you know, just, you know, stone rain them into oblivion.
Right. What are they going to like right now? This format, Scapeshift is a deck that's high on everyone's radar. Boom Bust is great against them. You have Tron decks, another deck that killing their lands is a problem. That's a deck high on everyone's radar. You have the Eldrazi deck. And then not to mention like in the format in general, there are 3 and 4 color decks that people want to kind of color, you know, you can color screw them out.
Right.
You have like the amount of different versatility uses and spell lands in this format. Like there's so much to do with that shell and getting to cast Boom Bust for free and then have a 4/4 menace and they have nothing.
Right.
Or you get one of your removal spells back. Like this completely can come into play and cast Abrupt Decay or cast Lightning Bolt or cast, you know, whatever other removal spell you need to stop what they're doing.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I get it. It's very good. I mean, no doubt about it.
Yep. All right.
So
I'm gonna do my just number 3 because we're on number 3 and
my
3
has already been said.
Okay, so you go first.
My number 3 is Kozilek's Return.
Okay,
and that's
about why you think it's a number 3 versus a number 8.
I mean, the more we've talked about it, to be honest,
versus an honorable mention.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So you can see here originally when I made my list, I'm showing it to Alex for proof that it was normally number 7. And Jory was number 3, and I switched them last minute. Like,
I'm very proud of that switch.
I don't think Jory is necessarily number 3, but I also don't think that Kozilek's Return is actually number 3. Because after we talked about it, the more I thought about it, it was like, the only deck that would want this, really, as an instant speed version of a Pyroclasm, would be a Tron deck, right? That would be the deal. But the thing is, if it's not Tron, then what deck is playing this? Because what other deck gets value off the second version? And if you're not going to get value off the second version, then why aren't you really just playing Pyroclasm? Because despite the fact that it's an instant, nobody plays Volcanic Fallout. I mean, like,
does the Eldrazi decks play a 7-drop?
I mean, they play big creatures, right? They play a couple big creatures.
I think they top out at 5, though. Yeah, I can't think of
the Eldrazi decks, not Tron.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I could be wrong. Like, my initial inclination on this card is this was the most expensive card, you know, from pre-order when the set was spoiled. So it makes me think that if I was to drop it super low, I'm missing something, because generally speaking, the most expensive card in pre-order when it's not a Planeswalker is a card that's probably going to be pretty good, but maybe not for Modern. Maybe it's just, we could be wrong. Tron could be huge and this card could be huge in it. We will see. I don't think I need to defend it. What do you guys have at number 3?
I have Thought Not Seer.
Only number 3.
Nice. Mine's higher than that too.
It's number 2 for me.
No, mine's not number 2 either. I wonder what it is.
Thought Not Seer is a card that is, let's just say, I think it's going to be in scarce supply by the time we get to the Pro Tour.
That card is nuts. I mean, it's made for Modern. It's a 4/4 Vendilion Click for 4. Like, what on earth? Like,
in terms of hitting the battlefield, it's actually a little better than Vendilion Click, right?
Because
they don't
better.
Get another. They don't. Well, they also don't get a card immediately.
Right.
When you do it, right? Like, there's sometimes you're like, oh, okay, Vendilion Click you, and you're like, they're like, take a card, and you're like, oh, cool, I drew some other card that I like.
Right.
You know, like, you know, you replace that card. And, you know, usually it's not good enough and you die to the Vendilion click. But, you know, sometimes you find your card a little sooner.
And
this they actually have to deal with this to get their card back.
Also,
to get a card back.
V-click, like, historically, you know, and I mean, this is in Legacy, this happens more often. But, like, Modern as well, it happens a pretty fair amount. Cast Vendilion click. Okay, before ability resolves, bolt your click. It's like, that's a standard thing that happens. And with this card, Lightning Bolt's not going to do much. Nor is Abrupt Decay.
Yeah, we just talked about how being Abrupt Decay proof and Lightning Bolt proof is like really good in the format. Well, one of the reasons I think Pod was an actual problem was because it cost 4 mana, not 3 mana.
Yeah, I mean, like it's and this card's going to be pretty nuts. And again, once again, in those Eldrazi decks we talked about, that at Reality Smasher, this was the other card in like the whole notion that like, a deck that was already creeping up people's lists is scary, is just getting Thought Knotseer and Reality Smasher just added to the format? Are you nuts?
You know, it feels a little bit like the Eldrazi deck is becoming the I mean, maybe you just said this and I'm just repeating you. Did you say becoming the Affinity deck?
No, but I think we called last week on the, or I called last week in the podcast that by next Pro Tour, Iavugan will be banned 100%. Like that's my bold prediction now.
Oh yeah, I've seen a couple of other people say it. Corbin Hosler's also said that a couple times.
Right.
And I mean it seems like it's going to be a gross card. But I mean it feels like there's just this like critical mass.
Yeah.
Well, of these really really good cards that are hard to deal with and just make your opponent's life miserable if they don't deal with them.
Right.
Right. You know, it's just like damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of cards.
Makes you feel like you wonder if they're trying to construct, if maybe part of the point of the Splinter Twin ban was to move Modern towards a format that's a little more just like, we're going to make 3, 4, and 5 more powerful than you guys can possibly imagine. And you're not going to be able to argue that combo decks and aggro decks are the best things because these cards we're printing are so good.
Man, I'm liking this Molten Rain deck more and more.
Well, I mean, like,
I'm only half kidding.
I know. There's a reason I put it in my top 5. It's my number 4. It's because that deck seems sweet. But I mean, my Thought Knotseer, if you haven't realized, is my number 1. First off, this is a 2-drop.
A
third of the time in the Eldrazi deck.
With Ugin and Temple, yeah.
Which is insane. The other thing is just like this.
Or Ugin and Urborg, both.
Ugin Urborg doesn't because you don't get free colorless. It's a 3-drop.
Sorry. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a 3-drop. But beyond that, like,
Ugin Temple.
My biggest complaint, I think, of the Splinter Twin ban is the mix up the format. They wanted to mix it up to get the thing so you'd have something in this set from the new set
in the
Pro Tour. But I think that was already going to happen. I think this deck was built to do well in this Pro Tour. And I think Splinter Twin was probably a decent matchup because of Thought Knotseer.
Yeah.
And now that's just not going to be a thing.
Warping Whale also does a little bit of work for that
right.
matchup.
Yeah, agreed. And so like it's a deck that I think already was well positioned to mix up the format, and now I'm afraid it might be just too good, and that's why the Ugin ban is being talked about, and we'll see at the Pro Tour. And
Warping Whale in a lot of ways does feel like a card that was designed to be good against the Modern that we saw at the time it was being designed. So when Splinterton was just like the deck and it was like the only deck, it's like, okay, well, this you know, this card exiles the two pieces of creature combo, so as well as just like being generally, you know, pretty versatile. And it's funny that now we have it and we don't need it anymore against Splinter Twin.
Right, yeah.
Oh, so interesting. Officially, my entire list has been spoiled. But all right, has everyone done their number three? Oh, my number three. My number three is Reality Smasher.
Okay, we've talked about that. Sweet.
It's going to smash realities. It's going to be sweet.
Yeah, that card is bonkers.
I think that card, like, the one point I have about it is, and this is also true with Thought Knotseer, I think both of those cards have home outside of just the Eldrazi deck. So, I think they're both powerful. Like, I had Thought Knotseer in my pre-release packet,
yeah.
And it was just the best card I had all week.
True story. At the pre-release, I played against our buddy Eric, and he opened a pool with 2 Reality Smashers in it.
Brutal.
But my pool was so so I opened all the cards, and I was like, God, this is an obscene amount of like conditional and cheap removal. But I was like, I didn't get anything good except for just a bunch of conditional and cheap removal. I was like, this deck sucks. And I play against Eric, barely lose game 1, mulligan out of game 2, and I'm like, I was right. We play 3 more games for fun, and I crush him, including 2 games in a row that he drew both Reality Smashers. I managed to win both of them, and then I win every game the rest of the tournament. Still ended up getting 3rd place just because I lost the first round. So annoyed.
All right, so, yeah, Reality Smashers good. I can't talk about it more. I think that card's sweet. I think 5 drops are better, hence my number 4. So let's move to number 2.
My number 2 is Worldbreaker. I actually went in a different direction for my big Eldrazi that I like. 6 green, 6 and a green for a creature Eldrazi. It's mythic rare. Devoid, when you cast Worldbreaker, exile target artifact, enchantment, or land. It also has reach, sort of randomly. And then it has two colorless, sacrifice a land, return Worldbreaker from your graveyard to your hand. I love this card. I think this card is just such a mirror breaker in these kind of like Eldrazi ramp decks. How fast do you think you can cast this card in a dedicated Eldrazi deck?
Turn four? It's an 8-drop?
Seven drop.
It's a 7-drop.
Okay. Turn four still for Tron?
If I cast this on turn four against maybe someone else who's setting up their Tron or setting up their Eldrazi engine, or, you know, you just suddenly put your opponent just full, you know, we've been talking about joking around about Molten Rain, but like this card actually just pushes your opponent off of their game plan.
Right.
If you're playing this card and you get to cast it and you have, I mean, heaven forbid you have some way to like sacrifice it and return it.
Right. You know? Well, and I would also say like having reach incidentally isn't that incidental in this format. Like this is the format where like Wall of Omens isn't the best thing on the planet because you have all of these flyers. It's specifically Infect and Infinity. So if you can get this on turn four, you're able to stop their Infect creature, and even better, you get to destroy their man land and then block their creature, or even in both with Affinity and Infect, which are those are the decks you need to block flyers and bad matchups for Tron. Even that does a lot of work right there.
Yeah, I like both of these. I like this in both Standard and Modern. Actually, I think this card's terrific.
My only issue with a card like this is that it definitely does something when you cast it, so it's good in that sense. But it is, it's not uncounterable. It's not like, I'm just imagining all these
its ability is uncounterable.
Yeah, the destroy a land is a cast trigger.
No, I know that. I just mean, but like you have to be able to, even if it is turn four, like there's so many aggressive decks in the format that are trying to close out their plan to kill you on turn four, but whether it's Affinity, whether it's Infect, whether it's Blue Red Delver.
Rarely have counter spells.
But how about I kill your Reality Smasher?
That is sweet. That is sweet. That's true. I mean,
Does that work? Is it considered the target of a spell?
No, I don't think so, because it's an enter the battlefield.
Oh, wait, no. It's a spell.
It's a when you cast.
Yeah.
Oh, it's when you cast.
Becomes the target of a spell and opponent controls counter that spell. I think it is a spell.
Okay. Interesting. But it's when you cast is when you get the ability.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So you get it no matter if it's countered. And so like against decks with counter magic, it removes a land or does the thing you want it to do. And against decks with creatures, the ones that are attacking you, they generally don't have counter spells. Like, right. Infect's not going to counter this because they don't have remand or anything. So this comes down and then blocks their attacker and blows up their man land. That's a big game. I thinking about it, I like this card a lot more than I did when reading it.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this card is very exciting. And I think if we are heading into a world of, you know, like big mana colorless decks or green black Eldrazi decks and Tron decks, that I think this is a card that actually just lets you still do what you do and also can put your opponent off their game.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. This is definitely of all the ones you've talked about when you said you wanted some of this are home run hitters. This is one that sounds to me like this is reaching for a home run. And if you're right, this will be the most you'll be able to say at the Pro Tour. I was on a podcast just a couple days ago talking about this is my number two card at the Pro Tour. It's on record. I called it. I have a hard time believing it, but I don't know, man. I mean, it's a powerful effect. I didn't realize it was when you cast it, so that changes the game.
The more you know. All right, what's your number two?
My number two was Thought Not To.
I think
you said all yours, and I think BDM and I pretty clearly have the same number one, unless you just did you not include Oath of Nyssa?
No, okay, so let's do our number two. Finish number two. Mine's Storm Chaser Mage. You have to give the exact layout.
Oh, sorry.
Don't ruin the countdown. My number two is Storm Chaser Mage.
Yep.
We talked about it already. It's really good.
It's super sweet.
Like, there's obviously a teamer like deck that's already built. That's prowessy and great.
That teamer deck, that's the one that plays like Rancor, right? And it plays like...
I'd play one Rancor with this. That seems sweet.
or
two of Rancor.
Oh, and Keen Sense? Doesn't it play Keen Sense? I thought I saw that deck plays Keen Sense. It does, right?
Keen Sense is
green Curiosity.
Oh, maybe.
I guess it would have just
play the blue Curiosity, can't they?
Yeah, it's true. I don't know why I thought that. I saw somebody streaming it. It seems awesome though.
The blue Keen Sense.
Yeah.
that deck's awesome. I definitely like I'm going to slide this in. I have the Prowess white version. I think I'm just going to make the green version and slide it in. All right, so.
So number one. Number one on my list is Oath of Nyssa. What is your number one, BDM?
Yeah, my number one is also Oath of Nyssa. I think this is the most ready-made card for the Pro Tour.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, for me, the reason that this goes in at number one is just like, okay, there's a few things that immediately come to mind, right? So this is a, you talk about Jund or you talk about Abzan, either one of those mid-range decks that will be a force, it always is, they're always good. This is a legendary enchantment. So it's going to dig on turn one, it's going to make casting your Liliana on turn three easier. It's also going to mean that when one blows up the other because of legendary rule, still triggers, and it makes your Tarmogoyf bigger in a deck that normally doesn't have an enchantment to make your Tarmogoyf bigger, which is very interesting on its own. It's like another card selection spell of three cards that you can play on turn one that right now all we really have is Serum Visions that is good, but it's, you know, like,
but it doesn't go into either of the two decks you just described.
And on top of that, Serum Visions is the single most played card in Modern. That or like Lightning Bolt.
No, it's Lightning Bolt Path, Serum Visions.
Okay,
so Inquisition of Kozilek.
It's in the top three.
Spellskite.
Like, Spellskite. Yeah. No, the fact that this is printed is like one of those things where you're like, it doesn't seem that powerful. Like, it doesn't seem like just over the top. It just seems like so completely a card that will be tried out in. Like, this gives you the ability to game plan so many different shells for rogue brews you want to come up with. That's the other cool thing. It's another one drop. I mean, I just think that's awesome. What do you think?
Yeah, it lets you play turn two Tybalt, right? Off of a green mana turn one, man. This is like, what more could you want? No, I love it. I mean, I'm super excited about this card. This was my preview card, actually, for Daily MTG.
Oh, really?
And, you know, I definitely feel like we've seen all the cool toys that blue used to get shifting into green, right? Like, you know, when was the last Ponder, you know, that was printed for blue?
Preordain was the last one that got printed, and that was like 4 or 5 years ago. Anticipate costs two, though.
Sure.
So, like, to get a single mana deck manipulation spell in green like this, that also just has all this incidental value that you already alluded to. In Modern, you know, like the ability to just go, oh, I don't really care what lands I have, I'm gonna play my Liliana of the Veil on turn three.
Right.
I guess the last
is just spectacular.
I guess the last unofficial one, the last, like, we'll call it a 0.5, was either Anticipate or Thoughtscour, because even though Thoughtscour didn't.
Thoughtscour is my favorite.
It doesn't.
Thoughtscour is my favorite of those cards.
It doesn't technically have card selection, but it sort of does.
Yeah, and the only way I could like Oath of Nyssa anymore is if it put those cards you didn't pick into your graveyard.
Oh, are you in Kessler Kindred Spirits? Are you like the dredge, like you love to fill your graveyard guy?
So the year Brad Nelson and David Ochoa made the top eight of U.S. Nationals playing Vengevine,
right,
was because I somehow bamboozled them into playing my deck.
Oh, yeah.
Vengevine, awesome. I think, is Alex's single favorite card ever.
That was my like first tier, and I guess it was tier two, but tier one deck I ever built. I had that Dredgevine list built. I was so happy.
That was like my jam. I played that incessantly. I love it. I love anything with things going to the graveyard. I mean, spider spawning is obviously like my favorite card. I played spider spawning in standard. I have a spider spawning. I have a spider spawning commander deck. Like, I just love graveyard shenanigans.
Dude, speaking of spider spawning, I played an Innistrad draft the other night at a local store. They just opened some boxes of it. And a bunch of these people that didn't know the format, one guy across the table did, and he got two spider spawnings, and he was trying to make that deck. But the beauty of it was, not only did I open Mare of Avabruk, which is like my single favorite card of the Bloodline Keeper to open in the whole set, some guy across the table, like one to the right of the spider spawning guys, opens a foil Daybreak Ranger, and it makes force passes around the table and makes its way to me in my green-white humans deck, which had, like, you know, basic, like, I opened all three drops in pack one. I was like, oh, this deck must not be open. Pack two, I open Mare, and I get past 5-2 drops in a row. Gastaff Shepherd, you know, the one that flips into a 3-3, like, just an awesome, awesome deck. Two travel preparations. It was so much fun.
And then you just lost to someone gnawing to the bone for 40.
No, I think I ended up losing in the finals to the guy that had the Invisible Stalker, you know, flight Butcher's Cleaver deck.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
which was like, it was really close. It was like one turn, but, you know, whatever. Yeah.
So, once again, I'm going to bring up Oath of Nyssa, lets you cast Nyssa and Liliana in the same deck.
Yeah.
Dropping the mic. No, that was my five.
I can't.
It's really good. I'm not saying it's not really good. I like it.
It's another one of these cards that, like, if you can get your hands on the foils before, like, if you find some way to get cheap foils because the card's being opened and, like, maybe it doesn't make as big of a splash in standard as people think after the modern season goes down and it's, like, a little more accessible, you can get your hand on a bunch of foils of this card. It's impossible in my mind that long-term the foil of this card is not worth money. It seems insane.
By the way, speaking of sweet foils I pulled, my number one, Thought Not Seer. I got my little promo card.
Oh, it was the foil?
It was the foil Thought Not Seer. I was very happy about that. Yeah, it's got a little date on it. It's so pretty. That card's sweet in foil, by the way. It's, like, so rainbowy.
I opened the...
So funny, those pre-release cards are so much rarer.
Yeah, yeah,
than,
yeah.
Like a foil rare or mythic rare with the pre-release stamp on it is, like, so much rarer. Like, the lands from the last set are so much rarer than the expedition versions of them.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, dude.
Nobody cares.
Right. No one cares. That's so funny.
I opened Dimensional Infiltrator as mine.
Oh, congratulations.
but I also, in another pre-release that I played, got the Mattery Shaper, and somebody promptly was like, I'll give you too much money for this. And I was like, what's it worth? And he was like, I'll give you too much money. I was like, all right, that's fine.
I've actually had a pretty good, I've gone Thought Not Seer as the thing. I got Abbot of Carol Keep.
Oh, sweet.
And Mortigens. And then for M15, I got Goblin Rabble Master as my, like, thing. I've, like, been hitting that
my best ever
rare in the set.
my best ever that I got was in one pack at M12's pre-release. I opened regular Primeval Titan foil Garruk in the same pack.
Yeah,
that was my best ever open. So
That's our top 10 list. Thought Not Seer is my number one. Your guys is Otha, Nissa, and they're all kind of...
Yeah, I mean, and Thought Not Seer was what, in the top three for everybody?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the consensus, like, probably best card. The Otha, Nissa is just the one that gets me the most excited.
Yeah, I think the top four, like, everyone had everything pretty bunched together. Storm Chaser Mage, Thought Not Seer, Otha, Nissa, Worldbreaker is, like, my outlier.
Yeah, and I had Goblin Dark Dwellers. Ben's list is probably the most correct, and then you and me had some sweet, way cooler cards.
You guys missed out on Jorian Ruin Diver. Get out of here!
it's in my honorable mention.
If only you didn't leave that as number four.
By the way, I also have Natural State in my honorable mentions.
Which one's Natural State?
It's just like G for a
That was my last
disenchant effect.
That card will see play. I can't imagine that not. Like, at some point, like, all the weird, really efficient artifact hate cards have always seen play in Modern. I can't imagine this not being among them.
Yeah, and it's just like the ability to for the aggro decks to have this without having to give their opponent life,
right? Or like,
which is what they currently have to do.
Right,
is a pretty big deal.
Well, like, Mono Green Stomp, you will play this. Any of, like, any green white deck will play this. Like the Noggles decks, I can imagine playing this. Boggles, not Noggles.
let's all rattle off. So you just gave one. Let's just do 5 seconds each. Like, no real explanation on a couple honorable mentions. So you just gave that one. I'll go with, for an honorable mention, Reflector Mage. I just think that card's probably pretty powerful. Probably bouncing it and replaying it with Angel is probably pretty strong. What do you got, Cass?
I'm surprised that card didn't see anyone's list. Actually,
it's a strong card. Yeah. I mean, it's really good.
It's on my honorable mentions as well. Actually, because I mean, again. You know, as you start looking for things to do to Reality Smashers, you know, that's a pretty nice thing to do to a Reality Smasher.
Right.
What do you got, Cass?
Flaying Tendrils. It's the all creatures get -2/-2 until end of turn. If a creature would die this turn, exile instead. That effect's just classically strong.
Yeah.
When you have a bunch of creature decks out there, if you're not playing red, it's like in junk decks, I can see the seeing play just as a, like, I need to wipe the board of Kitchen Fink so they go away forever.
Yeah, I don't have anger. Yeah, it seems strong. Another one that I threw in was Oath of Gideon.
I love that card.
It's really interesting. I mean, the reason it's really interesting, it's twofold. So number one, obviously, like, there's a lot of pretty aggressive decks in the format that, like, let's just say you're on the play and you can get 2/1s as part of your strategy to block. That's fine. Like, you don't really care if they both die the next turn blocking. But then the most important thing is that there's tons of 4-mana planeswalkers that are powerful that if you play them an extra loyalty, it's like a game changer.
That they can ultimate that turn. Or I think this card's better than people are giving it credit to. I mean, standards... For sure, and then in Modern, I can see it just because, like, it does the two things you want when in a Planeswalker Super Friends deck. It comes down on turn 3, so before most Planeswalkers come down, it then protects the Planeswalkers you play next, and it makes them way better.
Yeah, I'm not going to just start running through Planeswalkers, but if you think about, like, all of these different Planeswalkers that are always, like, borderline playable, but you're like, oh, I can't do it for X, Y, or Z reason, just the fact that they come down on 4, I mean, everybody knows, like, if you play, you know, Architect of Thought and it comes down on 5, like, it's significantly better, right? Like, there's just, all, like, both Kioras are probably, like, considerable. Like, there's just Narset. I mean, there's, like, real considerations if you're playing 4-mana Planeswalkers with this card. And it's just another one of those things that didn't make an effect that hasn't happened. I mean, I want to know really quickly, by the way, guys, just like I know we laughed about it, but like, do you disagree that like the notion that Dimensional Infiltrators rate not having existed until now is I'm serious.
I want to talk about my one weird pick, and I want you to tell me how great it is.
It was at the beginning, and so we were moving on. I'm just curious because, like, I've stated this to a few people, and most people have sort of scratched their head. And I'm wondering, like, why am I just seeing this totally incorrectly?
You made a compelling case for it. I mean, like, I could see it as like a, you know, as we talked about it a little bit more, like a, you know, going back to an older school of magic when you had, what was the name of that stupid card? It was red, blue, one for an Efreet. It was a 2/1 flyer. You flip a coin.
Oh, yeah. I know the
one. I don't know why I can't think of the name of it.
The one from Visions, are you talking about?
Yeah.
Rainbow Efreet? Is that the one?
Not the Rainbow Efreet. Rainbow Efreet you paid mana for. This was just flip a coin, and if you won the flip, it died, and if you lost, phased or if you won the flip, it just faded. It phased out.
Yeah, right.
So you could save. So it was difficult to kill. So, like, this is a card that you know, presents a certain amount of resistance to your opponent being able to deal with it.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, well, we don't have to harp on it. I'm just curious.
Lingering Souls, it's bigger.
Yeah, Lingering Souls. But Lingering Souls is a good card and is good against a lot of things. So, sure. Yeah, it doesn't, you know, it's not a reason to just discredit it. So, anyway.
My other honorable mention card is, I had Slip Through Space also in my honorable mentions, by the way, but
okay.
Mirror Pool.
Yeah, so my only thing with Mirror Pool is like, okay, with the deck that would most want to copy something would be a deck that's playing like a really big thing and, you know, wants to save its really big thing if it's going to get killed. And it's like, usually the turn you play the really big thing is the turn you'd want to copy. And when are you going to have 5 extra mana the turn you play a big thing?
So, yeah, I was thinking about stuff like with Delve, like if it's a Murderous Cut or something like that, where I think there's going to be cards that you can find that couldn't...
I mean, it's definitely a sweet, powerful card.
It's a really powerful
I'm like,
land.
I'm definitely going to put it in like, a lot of EDH decks.
I definitely want to, you know, do it to a Treasure Cruise in Standard.
Yeah. That seems so sweet. Awesome.
Yeah. Right, five mana, draw 6.
Oh, man.
Yeah, seems good. All right, well, that wraps up our top 10 cards most likely to see play at Pro Tour Oath of the Gatewatch on the Masters of Modern podcast.
Oh, I have a weird honorable mention really quick. All right, Eldrazi Displacer.
Oh, yeah, that's 2 and such a white. A sweet card.
And then it's Devoid, and then you have 2 in a colorless. You can exile another target creature, then return the battlefield under its owner's control. It actually saw play. It was in the Eldrazi deck in the sideboard.
Tapped, right? Doesn't it enter it tapped?
Yes, tapped.
It's like Maze. This is like Maze of Ith's creatures for 3. Yeah.
It's sweet.
Nuts.
No. I like it a lot.
Yeah. And you didn't say the magic words, training grounds.
Yeah, no. I've said those magic words, BDM, on this podcast more times than you know. And the first place I go every time I see an activated ability for 3 is I was literally on the way here thinking like, okay, like what could you do with Dimensional Infiltrator and Mind Shrieker and training grounds? I was like, how could I sell this on the episode? But anyway.
Oh, there's one thing. Wandering Fumarole, the land, it goes infinite with a card. It makes a card get infinitely big. I forgot what it is. It's like a 3-drop 1/1 from like Shadowmoor block, but basically every time an activated ability is activated, it gets +1/+0.
Huh.
So with this, you just and you get an infinitely large dude.
Huh.
Interesting.
I don't know how good that is, but that's a thing I forgot to bring up, and I remembered. This is like the footnotes of this episode.
If a creature's activated ability is activated?
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. So all right.
Yeah, there you go.
So, I'm in.
Even better.
Would that mean that the 2 of the 3-drop troll and like a Shuko, you could like do the same thing?
With if you had another, if yeah, you could.
It, for 2 sure. of the troll, Shuko, in this card, you could activate it and then just like bounce the Shuko between the trolls to make.
Yeah, deck. We're making it right now. Let's do it. All right, cool. Once I said, once again, $10 to anyone who plays that deck and top 8s the Pro Tour. $10 and a Masters of Modern side play mat.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up the episode. BDM, thank you so much for hanging out and talking. This has been so fun.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I hope I hope a couple of these cards make their way to the top 8 at the Pro Tour in a couple days.
Yeah,
well,
me too.
Hopefully we'll have a good laugh about it next time we talk to you on here. In the meantime, what are you working on? What can you tell the folks about?
Well, I mean, the one of the big efforts for me right now is Emergence Genesis, the deck building game,
okay.
Which is a deck building game that I kickstarted with some, you know, co-creators. We published the game. It's out in stores right now. If it's not in your store, you can tell them to order it from ACD Distribution. ACD is carrying the game. And
can they find that online as well?
They can find it online. Channel Fireball carries it. Cool Stuff Inc. carries it. We sell it on our page at UrbanIslandGames.com.
All right.
You know, it's definitely out there. It's a lot of fun. It's getting really great reviews. It is the fusion of my two great passions in life, which is games and comics. I worked with some real comic book artists who do work at Marvel and DC on a lot of mainstream titles to create this superhero universe of characters that I invented to create this game world.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, and it's something that I'm really excited about and I'm really proud of. And, you know, I just, you know, been trying to get the word out about it. So, you know, if you played it, if you've seen it, you know, you want to go on the Board Game Geek and give us a review, that's awesome. You know, and if you go into your local game store, you go, hey, how come you don't have Brian's game?
Yeah, yeah.
that's super helpful.
We should go yell. We'll go yell at them at Heidi Ho tomorrow if they don't have it.
Yeah. How do they find you on Twitter, the internets? How do they find you?
I'm at Top 8 Games. Pretty easy to find me. I'm always there talking about TV, food, panda bears, anything. You know, all the time on Twitter, I'm pretty engaged.
Are you a big TV guy?
Oh, I talk about TV. Wait, I watch so much TV.
What's your favorite show right now? I've killed so many novels. What's your favorite show right now?
Right now I'm enjoying the hell out of Sense8.
Okay, yes,
which I hadn't watched. I loved it, but the big show for me this year was Fargo.
Yeah, Fargo was. I worked the premiere. I interviewed a bunch of folks on that show, and this is my favorite story from that premiere. There's an actor named Bokeem Woodbine.
He's great.
Yeah, he's great. So Bokeem's coming down the carpet, and he comes up to me, and I'm like, dude, I am so excited to talk to you. He's like, oh, cool, man. Thank you so much. Everybody's wanting to talk to Patrick Wilson, Kirsten Dunst. And I'm like, you have a role in one of my all-time favorite movies. You're never going to guess. He's like, and he's totally taken aback because I'm way too excited. And he's like, what movie's that, man? And I'm like, Almost Heroes. You played Jonah, Chris Farley's last movie. You were amazing. And he's like, and he just looks at this look of disbelief. And he's like, I did not think you were going to say that movie, man. That is proceeded to be like one of my best interviews I've ever gotten. It's hilarious. He couldn't stop laughing. So yeah, Fargo's great. That's awesome.
All right. Now, and to remind all of you guys, make sure to follow us on Twitter. We are at the MMCast. I am personally at Kes Wiley.
I'm at Ben Bateman Media.
And make sure to check out our sister podcast, The Command Zone. They do awesome Commander content. They're super sweet.
Yeah, they're great. BDM, thanks so much, man. We'll shout you out with this, and good luck at the Pro Tour, man. I hope Worldbreaker is the card you want it to be. we'll be.
I mean, I've got my money on Oath of Nyss. I've only got Worldbreaker to place.
Yeah.
So
do we want a gentleman's bet what's Jor-El? What was your
Jori-En?
Jori-En, Worldbreaker, or what was mine? The Goblins. Dark Dwellers. Whichever one places the highest, that person owes the other two people like a dinner.
Do I have the choice between Dimensional Infiltrator and Jori? Do I have the choice between Jori-En and Dimensional Infiltrator?
Yeah, you have a choice.
I'll take Jori-En.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in. I'll even cook the dinner if one of you guys wins.
Fantastic.
Loser buys cake. Oh, yeah. I think that's
also,
the better.
Also, by the way, YouTube Kitchen Table Gaming is somewhere else you can find me.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Cool.
Please subscribe to the channel. I'm going to be making more as soon as I get back from the Pro Tour.
Great.
Super cool, man.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Yep. Thanks, everybody on the internet. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.